We're in Matthew chapter 26. Jesus is done with his public ministry. He's done with his public teaching on earth. There should be a sobering, you know, I don't know that too many people recognize still what was going on and how it was going to look. In this next passage, one person did, Mary did, and I think she recognized that and had an absolutely correct response to it. But Jesus' public ministry is done. So now he's heading towards fulfilling what he came here ultimately to do, and that's to be the substitutionary sacrifice for our sins. Let's pray. God, I don't know why you tolerate me at times in my lack of honor and respect and reverence for you and what you've done, but I thank you that you haven't struck me dead yet. Continue to give us time to respond to you correctly and have a right relationship with you. I ask that you'd further that today, not only in the next few minutes of teaching, but that you would further that in our time spent together. I thank you for the privilege and honor of being your chosen people. Here we are, opposite side of the world, and we're able to be the recipients of the promises of Abraham and the fulfillment of the covenants that you made. And I thank you that we can be called your people and your children. Jesus, I thank you. I thank you. And in the next few weeks here, as we finish out the historical writings of Matthew and see the end of your ministry here on earth is projected by Matthew, that we would not be able to take it lightly, that we would gain new meaning and get new perspective on what happened, what's going down here. I look forward to what you want to teach us now and today and in our time together. Cause us to be glorifying to you in our time together. It would be right as you would want it to be, that it would be a love feast. Amen. Let's read this first part of the chapter. We're not going to get through verse 30, but hopefully next week we'll deal with the last verses in it. And it came about that when Jesus had finished all these words, remember he just finished up teaching the parables and just finished up the teaching about the sheep and the goats. And he said, and it came about when he had finished all these words, he said to the disciples, "You know that after 2 days the Passover is coming, and the Son of Man is to be delivered up for crucifixion. Then the chief priests and the elders of the people were gathered together in the court of the high priest named Caiaphas. And they plotted together to seize Jesus by stealth and kill him. But they were saying, 'Not during the festival, lest a riot occur among the people.' Now when Jesus was in Bethany at the home of Simon the leper, a woman came to him with an alabaster vial of very costly perfume, and she poured it upon his head as he reclined at the table. But the disciples were indignant when they saw this and said, 'What is the point of this waste? For this perfume might have been sold for a high price and the money given to the poor.' But Jesus, aware of this, said to them, 'Why do you bother the woman? For she has done a good deed to me. For the poor you have with you always, but you do not always have me. For when she poured the perfume upon my body, she did it to prepare me for burial. Truly I say to you, whenever this gospel is preached in the whole world, what this woman has done shall also be spoken of in memory of her.' Then one of the 12 named Judas Iscariot went to the chief priests and said, "What are you willing to give me to deliver him up to you?" And they weighed out to him 30 pieces of silver, and from them on he began looking for a good opportunity to betray him. Now on the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the disciples came to Jesus saying, "Where do you want us to prepare for you to eat the Passover?" And he said, "Go into the city to a certain man and say to him, 'The teacher says, my time is at hand, and I am to keep the Passover at your house with my disciples.'" And the disciples did as Jesus had directed them, and they prepared the Passover. Now when evening had come, he reclined at table with the 12 disciples. And as they were eating, he said, "Truly, I say to you that one of you will betray me." And being deeply grieved, they each one began to say to him, "Surely not I, Lord." And he answered and said, "He who dipped his hand with me in the bowl is the one who will betray me. The Son of Man is to go, just as it is written of him. But woe to that man through whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It would have been good for that man if he had not been born." And Judas, who was betraying him, answered and said, "Surely it is not I, Rabbi." He said to him, "You have said it yourself." So, this passage is recorded in this event. Some of these events are recorded in both Matthew and Mark and in John. I don't know, I would like to think that you guys have studied it to the point and looked it over to the point where you're bothered by the fact that they don't seem to be coincide chronologically, and there seems to be some differences chronologically. Probably you haven't. I don't want to bring disturbing news about the difficulty of putting it together. But there is an answer, be assured. I'm not exactly sure what the answer is yet. I ended up being pretty much consumed by it yesterday in studying, how do they correlate as far as time goes. I am absolutely convinced, there's not error in this. This is divinely inspired, and that's not just wishful thinking. I think that it's pretty well proven, beyond a shadow of a doubt. And I think it is important when, we talked about it, I believe, last Easter. Jesus was to be 3 days and three nights in the earth, right? And how did that look, right? When did that happen? What's the timeline of Jesus' death? And, I would challenge you that it's not okay. I don't believe it's like, they were just kind of confused, or maybe there's some error there, or to let it slip into your mind, that they don't agree, and therefore one of them's wrong, and so something's wrong in the timeline here. Cause that's not the answer. Okay? And Jesus, the question becomes, in the timeline, when did they have the supper, is really the question. And I'll just throw it out in case at some point in your life you hear, or in case sometime in your life you study it, and you kind of see that there's some variance there. I'm not sure that'll happen. I would hope so, okay? I would hope so. Excuse me. What is taught here is absolutely relevant and absolutely important for us. And the timeline is not an issue of error in the Bible. So for right now, I'll pretty much leave it like that. The issue, I really believe what's happening, John is the gives a real true dateline of it. And I believe that Matthew, in speaking, oftentimes, and it was legitimate when they were recording history, to go back and forth in time dates in order to explain events and to give you a better understanding of what history. In this case, this is not a true chronological order of things, but I believe it's Matthew's attempt to explain the events that were happening, i.e. Judas and Judas's betrayal and why. Okay? And he's interjecting the story at this point in order to define that. John records this story as, a few days prior, as 6 days when they were coming in prior to his triumphal entry, that the event happened where Jesus was anointed with the perfume. Okay? I believe that's true. I don't think that's, there's not a problem there in understanding it, but that's when it happened, and Matthew interjects it at this point looking like this in order to give us the understanding of why, what motivated Judas and what pushed him over the top. Okay? So for those of you I know that in this week of studying you were really troubled by that, there's a better understanding of it, okay? The understand this, that when Jesus was coming into Jerusalem at this time, he was basically a wanted man. He had, you know, there was in so many words a warrant for his arrest out, right? They'd put a warrant for his arrest. They told people, when you see him, let us know so that we can arrest him, so that we can take him in custody. So Simon the leper, Lazarus, the whole group were in somewhat of a risk, right? The high priest, they decided, well, we want to be a little bit careful because we don't want the people to riot. Remember, there's a whole bunch of really staunch followers from Galilee that are down here right now in Jerusalem. Okay? Again, a town that was maybe 100,000 typically, Jerusalem, during the year. Josephus says it was somewhere between 2.5 and 3 million during the Passover. That's a lot of people in town. Okay? That's a lot of people in town without established houses and where we live and what were happening. I mean, that's real potential for a riot, right? And they're all here and they're all pretty fired up. But there was two and a half million potentially is probably a fairly minimum number that were in there. You know, I was thinking somewhere between 1 million and 2 million people. Josephus records that it is about between 2.5 and 3 million, who's a historian of the day. This is a pretty wild time Jesus is coming in. Remember when he's going to do it again. He had already turned the tables over once, okay? And you have to understand that history seems to show that Caiaphas, who was the high priest at the time, his brothers were very, very involved in the trade and sale in the temple. So there was a huge conflict of interest because Jesus had already once caused a lot of trouble in that, right? Turned over the tables. I would challenge you all, both as men and as women, to not lose sight of that. You know, it's given to us for a purpose, where a couple times he walked in. I mean, this was huge. I mean, the temple was a big courtyard, the Herod's temple. It was three times what the original temple was, and it was primarily for commerce, is the size of it was enlarged. That commerce was the buying and selling. You know, understand that on this Passover, there would probably be between the hours of 3 and 5 on the day of the Passover, they would kill 250,000 sheep. 200 and this was in the temple. This was slitting their throats. This was bleeding them out. This was priests, one holding it and slitting their throat, another priest holding a bowl below him and holding the sheep while it bled out and bled and filled the bowl. And he would take the blood and put it on the altar from each sheep. I mean, think of that scene. You know, that if we saw that scene right now, if we knew a civilization that was doing that scene right now, we would say burn them. Right? I mean, they would be, oh my gosh, you know. They're sheep. Understand that the ink is in the ass. They weren't humans. Okay? As many people have let blood and done the same kind of thing. These are sheep, and God had told them to do this. But still, the blood ran from the temple down the side of the mountain, clear into the brook Kidron. It says it flowed red. That's what I'm doing. Okay? I mean, there's gallons and gallons and gallons of blood that were spilled out. They caught some in the bowl, threw it on the fire. That probably smelled good, huh? So, I mean, this is a wild, wild scene that is happening in Jerusalem at this time. Obviously, there's going to be some people pretty amped up and going. They were concerned about Jesus. They were concerned about arresting Jesus because of the support of him and what could happen. People were pretty wound up, obviously. Jesus is the Passover lamb. Okay? He is the Passover lamb. All of that killing of sheep, killing of blood, and killing of goats is done. There's no longer a purpose for that. In the city, because Jesus was the fulfillment of that. That's a huge deal. I mean, this is a long time they've been doing this, right? God commanded him to do this. A long time they've been doing this. Judas is an interesting character, and we don't know a lot about him. But you know, Judas Iscariot means he was, kind of tells us where he was from. He was from Judea. Probably he was the only one of the disciples probably from Judea, from the southern part of Israel, which was the richer, more educated, more prosperous part. The Galileans were seen as kind of the barbarian. You know, they were Bellevue guys, And Judea was Ketchum, or something, So, this was a... okay, we'll go Wood River Valley and Twin Falls. I mean, what do you want to do? That's not real for anybody who's thinking that I really believe that way and they hear this. I don't believe that. But, nonetheless, if you go to the high school, you would think it was true. So, it's interesting that Jesus put him in charge of their money. Right? He put him in charge of the money bag, which, what was that for? I would assume that it might have been for buying food and whatnot, and purchasing, I would assume. They didn't seem to, we don't ever talk about him purchasing lodging, but even more, it seemed to be that it was for helping the poor, for alms. Where they got the money, I'm not sure. I don't know if it was charitable contributions, I would assume. That people did and supported the ministry. And Judas was in charge of that. I would be pretty certain that Jesus knew the character and nature of Judas. Okay? You want to be careful in your division because we do this far too often. Judas's heart was not obvious. Nobody suspected him, right? Understand that in this, nobody saw this coming in Judas. There's no hint in any way that anybody, when Jesus wanted us going to betray him, and they all went, that guy, it's the guy in the black over there, The guy with the black hat, it's him that's going to do it. Nobody had... There's no indication that anybody had the least amount of suspicion about Judas. I mean, that says a lot to me. Okay? I mean, do I think that he had a heart, that wanted to know Jesus? I do. Right? I mean, I don't think Jesus would have, if he would have been rebellious and had no heart to know Jesus, it would have been pretty obvious the rest of them after 3 years. They lived with him 24/7, right? It would be pretty obvious. I don't believe that he was stealing from the money bags, Jesus said, okay? Nobody knew that, okay? The depths of his heart was pretty hidden. On the outside, he looked like one of the other 12. We don't have a lot of description, Peter, John, Paul. I mean, Peter, John, are known as disciples that they're talked about. Some of the other, Bartholomew and some of the other disciples, not a lot is said about. Not a lot of Philip, not a lot of stuff. They aren't said a lot about, but Judas, a little bit is said about, but there's no indication that he was this radical rogue, in the midst of them. And they certainly wouldn't have trusted him with their money if they thought he was, right? And here he was in charge of the money. So I think that it's important for us to see that a heart, a wicked heart, is not necessarily so obvious. I mean, in one passage it says that at the Last Supper he was open and given over to the authority of Satan right in the midst of him. At one point he says that sinner, the devil himself was present at the Last Supper, and he entered Judas. And nobody noticed. You know? We tend to think of somebody who's controlled by the enemy as slobbering at the mouth, and, you know, like the demoniac that Jesus met maybe when in Gesaria, you know, when they pulled up on the ship and this guy was running around naked and crazy and they were trying to chain him up and the guy was breaking the chains and they were, you know, we tend to think of him as, that's what a demoniac, that's what somebody looks like. He was possessed by demons. This guy, Judas, was possessed by Satan himself. The ruler of the demons. Nobody noticed in the room. So to me that's something that's important. Spiritual discernment is critical. Spiritual discernment. You know, Jesus knew. And Jesus, you know, Jesus didn't come up with some concept that, wait, this is a demon-free zone. Right? Can't be around here. Right? I mean, there was demons around Jesus. And he allowed it. Right? Was he able to exercise authority over demons? Obviously, time and time and time again in the New Testament, he exercised authority over demons. Radical authority that said, leave this person, be gone. And do not enter them again. I'm doing it. And that happened time and time again. But Jesus was always understood, and this is something that is very important. I don't believe as long as we're on this earth, there's such a thing truly as a demon-free zone. Okay? Now, number one, I guess the big problem here is we have to believe other demons. There are demons. Okay? And Satan is real. This is not a concept. He's as real as the Spirit of God. Okay? Absolutely is real. And if you do not believe in demons and you do not believe in the devil in as real of a way, well, I will put it this way. You will believe in them as real as you believe in God. Okay? Because they are both spirit. And if you cannot believe in demons, you know, I would contend you don't believe in God as God is, as spirit. But there is the reality that the demons were subject to the authority of Jesus. Okay? We can be in a zone where the demons are subject to the authority of Jesus. Okay? And I would suggest we try to live in such a zone for the majority of our life. Particularly when we are in the context of those who are claiming to know God. In the context of those who are claiming to know God, Judas was present. Right? But the demons were under the authority. I think that there is a incredibly radical, cataclysmic battle that happened. I mean, it was UFC at its greatest in the desert. I don't mean to mock or belittle, but when Jesus and Satan had it out. We talked about that earlier at the beginning of his ministry. And he said, you need to understand something. You need to understand that I win. Okay? I win. You don't have the right to relentlessly, openly confront me. Okay? And that happened in the desert. Satan just pounded him and pounded him and pounded him. And I believe that it was established that, you know, I serve my Father and my Father and I'm under the authority and I'm under the power of my Father, and you do not exercise and have authority over me. I believe that's a point we should come to in our lives. Okay? I'm confident that all of us should come to that point in our life, where we can live in that way. That's not to deny the reality of the demonic, or be unaware of the demonic. Because did Satan go away and hide and tuck his tail? No. He was in the room at the Last Supper. He possessed one of Jesus' disciples. He did not run away and tuck his tail. He was still very much at work trying to kill Jesus, trying to keep him from becoming the Messiah. Again, it seems fairly clear, and I am certain that that Satan misunderstood, just like the Jews misunderstood, that Jesus was going to set up his kingdom there and rule and reign. But I believe Satan understood that to mean that he was in deep trouble when that happened. Okay? That when Jesus sets up and rules and reigns on this earth, that Satan's dominion, that Satan is the prince of the power of this world, that Satan controls this world now, that would be gone. That he would be taken out of his position of power. Exactly what will happen to him? I don't know. I'm sure at this point he's read the scripture and says he'll be cast into the abyss. Okay? To be locked up forever, that he'll be taken away at some point. Okay? But he also knew that if Jesus came and established his authority and his reign on this earth, that Satan's rule and reign would be in trouble. He would be taken out of his position. So he was relentlessly trying to thwart Jesus from becoming the Messiah, from being set up. And I believe that it seems to me, by all accounts, that he believed, just like the Jews did. He knew Jesus was a Messiah, okay? Different than some of the Jews knew that. But he believed it from prophecy. He read the Old Testament. And from prophecy, he understood that the Messiah would establish his kingdom on earth, and Jesus would rule and reign. And I think that's what he was trying to thwart, and that's what he was trying to stop. I think that's why he was pushing so hard through the priests, through the Sanhedrin, through Judas, through everything, to kill Jesus before that happened. Okay? He didn't understand that. And it's one of the reasons why I think it is so difficult to find that in the Old Testament. Is it there? Absolutely it's there. Looking back on it, it's easy to see. Okay? But at the time, in reading it, it's difficult to see on doing it. And I believe that was part of it, was not wanting the enemy to know his plans. I think the same thing is happening here. Jesus knew what his destiny was. Jesus knew what his purpose was. Jesus knew that he was coming here purposely to be the propitiation, the substitutionary sacrifice for us. And that was essential to satisfy not a terrible, wicked, wretched, evil God, but a just and holy and righteous God, where all sin will be judged. And God said, substitutionary, I will provide the way of escape. I will do it so that you can have a right relationship with me. There's nothing more fair. There's nothing more kind. There's nothing more benevolent. There's nothing more loving. And God's saying, I will kill my own son in your place. Okay? I will kill my son in your place. Death, sin brings death. And his justice is perfect. And his righteousness is perfect. And his holiness is perfect. Not relative, but perfect and absolute. And the necessity of shed blood for the covering of sin was there. And bulls of the blood of sheep and goats was only substitutionary. It was only looking forward to the death of the perfect Messiah, of the perfect Lamb. Jesus had to die. That was his purpose. That's what he was doing. This is where he was headed. And I think I think that all of us on some level, and as I begin to look at it, it would be very careful, just like I warn us oftentimes about separating ourselves so far from the Pharisees, right? And we tend to separate ourselves, though those guys were idiots. Those guys were self-righteous, pompous idiots. Not like us Calvary Chapel guys, you know, doing it. I mean, We're much more open-minded than that. I would encourage you to not separate yourself that far from Judas, but to look at his heart. I believe Judas wanted to hang with Jesus. I believe Judas wanted to be part of the Messiah reigning. Judas wanted to be part of the kingdom. You know, I believe that's why he was purposeful. I believe that's why he got very discouraged. Okay? Because it just wasn't going well that way. I mean, how, if you're going to set up a kingdom, what are you doing? You know? Why are you wasting the opportunity to be politically esteemed and have the people follow you? Why do you say things like, unless you eat my body and drink my blood, you have no part in me? And cause 5,000 people to leave. We needed them. I mean, we're going to Jerusalem. We're going to overthrow the Roman government. Okay? I mean, we got to have the people with us. I mean, can we get this done? There's 2.5 million people. I don't know how many Roman soldiers, but they had to be on edge. Right? I mean, there was a few of them, but not enough. By any means. And the Jewish people were already discontent by a bunch of ways. By the taxes they had to pay, by the taxation, by the rule that they had over them. They were already discontent. And there was already factions of extremism that were already, you know, out there and happening. The zealots, you know, was a group, a political group, you might say, that were hated the Roman rule and were willing to actively be terrorists in the process. Been going on for a long time. And I think that Judas, I mean, I mean, his name is a good name. I mean, he's a worshiper, man. I mean, talk about ruining a good name. I mean, nobody would name their kid Judas now. Right? I mean, you know, nobody would, because everybody knows, even pagans know Judas. You know, you're a traitor. You're a betrayer. You know? That's what a Judas is, right? Is a betrayer, is a bad person. I think that Judas was, I mean, I think he was a zealous Jew. I think he knew the scripture. I don't see him, he didn't stand out radically within the disciples, okay? We have no indication that they're going, Jesus, why is he hanging out with us? Why is this guy one of us, man? What's he doing here? I mean, he seemed to fit in pretty well. But what was his deal? You know? I mean, he wanted to prosper. He wanted to prosper from his relationship with the Messiah. How different is that from the vast majority of American Christians? I mean, we sell Christianity in this country as God will bless your life. God will prosper your life. God will, you know, your life will, you know, God wants you a child of the king, therefore you should live like a child of the king. God will bless you as a child of the king, right? I mean, we have a difficult time in this country separating. We've talked about this before, but I challenge all of you to try to cleanse your heart, myself included. We tend to see those who are impoverished, those who are subsistence living, those who are barely getting by, as not having the blessing of God, and it's very hard for us to see those who are prospering, especially those who sing songs and about God and say words about God and go to church, who are financially prospering, as having the blessing of God. Right? They have the blessing of God. The other guys don't have the blessing of God because God wouldn't want them. We equate those things pretty closely in American culture. I mean, do not put such a division between us and Judas. Judas saw the same thing. He saw the same thing. And to put it in perspective, let's just... Now, when Jesus was at Bethany at the home of Simon the leper, verse 6 of chapter 26, a woman came to him with an alabaster vial, a very costly perfume, and she poured it upon his head and as he reclined at the table. This is something called spikenard. It's one of the essential elements, essential oils, even. I don't know. I don't know the current thing. I know there's a current trend of essential oils. I don't know what that looks like. But spikenard is one of them, okay? It's a plant in a dry root that they extracted this from. It grew in northern India. Still does, you know. Primarily northern India, Nepal, Tibet, up in there. It's 3 to 5,000 meters, you know, which is like, you know, 10,000-15,000 feet. Like, real high elevation. That's a long ways from Palestine, okay? The Dead Sea is like way below sea level. So, spikenard didn't grow there, right? It was seen as a very, very precious, oil or ointment on doing it, that was extracted. It was imported from northern India, Tibet in the trade, in these alabaster boxes or vials in doing it. And alabaster also became known as just a name for the things that contained perfume doing it. The worth and the value of it, was about a year's wages. So when you think of that and put it in perspective, it was, what, $20,000-$30,000 worth of oil. Okay? That's a bunch. That's not a $50 bottle of perfume. Okay? In the day, it was a $50 bottle of perfume. All right? But $50 was what a person made in a year. Okay? That's what a person made in a year. So it was, you know, this is a $20,000-$30,000 bottle of perfume. So it's important for us all, as we condemn those who mocked Mary for doing this, what would we think? What would we think? How would we take that? How would we take it if somebody did such an extravagant thing? I mean, come on! Could have sold that and fed the poor. You know how many people that would have taken care of? You know? In our culture, I admit, it's hard for us to get our heads wrapped around. Somebody poured perfume on my head and I'm going to beat him. Okay? Alright? So, it is difficult for us to wrap our head around this as being a good thing. Alright? It was an essential oil. Still is an essential oil. Still is something that's used. It's an antifungus, an antibacterial. It was, you know, it was used to prepare people for burial. But man, this is an expensive pint, potentially pound, some say, you know, of perfume. Okay? That she poured the whole thing on Jesus. And I, you know, it's easy, they're all on, you know, nobody seemed to go, hey, you guys be quiet, that's a good thing she's doing, except Jesus, right? One of the other accounts said the ringleader of saying this is stupid was Judas, kind of, saying, what are you doing? But that would be expected. He was the finance guy, man, right? This is the guy that's the responsible one around here. This is the guy that's, you know, he's the responsible one, you know. He's not like you flakes, you know, that don't care about money. He's the responsible one that cares about money and is a good steward of his money. Obviously, we see that, you know, took a bent that took him completely away from God, took him completely away from a right relationship with Jesus doing. But understand, that was an extreme thing that happened. It's interjected here. It's a true event that happened. It's interjected here in order to give us the understanding of what pushed Judas over the edge. Okay? Because I think this was an event that pushed him over the edge. There was plenty. He looked at this and goes, you know, here we come in. We're supposed to come in and be heralded as the King of the Jews. You're supposed to come in and set up your reign. And you're telling us you're going to die. You keep telling us you're going to die, and you've got a warrant out for your arrest. You're doing things that turn the people's heart away from you, and you're not doing any of the right things to establish a kingdom. I mean, $30,000-$40,000 could help our cause a little bit, right? I mean, you know, come on, it takes $1 million to run a political campaign here. What are you doing? You know, it takes a lot of money to get in, and This guy is not what he claims to be. Because of Judas's it's not a heart that's very far from any of us. And it's not a heart that's very far from our culture, for sure. And yet, what was Jesus' response to it? Now understand, did Jesus ever... I don't see anywhere in the gospel, and tell me if you see different, I don't see anywhere in the gospel where Jesus allowed himself to be treated as a king. Okay? Hey, come on, you guys. Put me on one of those little boxes with poles on it, and I'm tired, you know? Carry me around, or however it might look. Give me a chariot. You know? I mean, come on. We got 10,000 followers here at times, right? I mean, a buck a piece, man, a donation box. We're good. I can get a new chariot. You know? I mean, I get pretty tired running around here doing it. And did Jesus ever allow himself, have any indication that he allowed himself to live lavishly? But he went without food. Okay? Jesus... He didn't go buy a home. Jesus had no place to lay his head. He didn't go buy a home. He apparently rented a place in Capernaum for a fair part of his ministry. That would be my assumption. He rented it. I'm not exactly sure how it went. It didn't talk about money transaction there. But he took up residence in Capernaum. Okay? And he didn't live... He didn't move himself down to headquarters in Jerusalem where he was going to do it. I mean, Jesus never, he didn't say, you know, treat me like a king, lavish me. Let's have a good steak dinner or something, you know. I mean, anyway, we don't see this happening. And all of a sudden, this Mary pours $30,000 worth of perfume on him. And no wonder everybody's indignant. This goes completely contrary to what had ever happened. Right? And what's Jesus say? This is good. This is a good thing. You guys do not condemn me. This is a good thing that happened here. Here's Mary. Some have speculated it's Mary Magdalene. This was not Mary Magdalene. Mary Magdalene, potentially an earlier place, cried and washed Jesus' feet with her tears in her hair at an earlier time, but that was not here. That was up in Galilee. In Bethany, this was one of Lazarus' sisters. It wasn't Mary Magdalene. Mary and Martha were Lazarus' sisters. Remember, Jesus had raised Lazarus from the dead. That was a big deal. These were obviously fairly prominent people in Jewish culture and society. The Jews actually, you know, at one point the multitude were coming out, it says, to see Jesus, wanting to come out and see Jesus. They also just as much wanted to see Lazarus being raised from the dead, they said. He was a prominent person in Jewish society, highly respected, it seems. And you know, when he raised him from the dead, that was known by everybody. And Mary and Martha were, we don't have any record of them being married or, but that they, in fact, some would say that this perfume was her dowry. We don't know about a father. And dowries went both ways. Sometimes the father would give the bride a dowry. You know, I don't know what you'd say. You know, sometimes it was land. Sometimes it was precious jewels. Obviously, you know, a year's wages, $30,000 is a good dowry to start marriage with, potentially. I don't know exactly where that comes from. But a lot of commentary talks about it being potentially her dowry that she spent and gave up there. Every time this Mary's talked about, she's talked about sitting at the feet of Jesus and worshiping him. She obviously was very spiritually discerning. Okay? How do I say that? Because Jesus says something that's interesting. What is the point of this waste? For this perfume might have been sold for a high price and the money given to the poor. But Jesus, aware of this, said to them, "Why do you bother the woman? For she has done a good deed to me. For the poor you have with you always, but you do not always have me. When she poured this perfume upon my body, she did it to prepare me for burial. How many people you think in that room understood that Jesus was really going to die and get buried, be raised again? He told them, okay? But nobody got it. Not anybody that I know. Not anybody that we see any record of. The disciples certainly didn't get it, right? I don't know what Lazarus did or Martha did. We don't know anybody got it. Nearly got it. I don't think it was Jesus claiming, you know, falsely giving her good motives. Okay? This is Jesus reading her heart and saying, she's preparing me for burial. She knows what's going down here. She's spiritually discerning. I've said it. Jesus had said it a bunch of times. Okay? But nobody, it didn't click because they had their presuppositions about what it was supposed to look like. And our presuppositions sometimes are our worst enemies. Because they keep us from seeing truth that's right in front of our face. They obviously saw it in front of her face and was hugely taken by this. The Messiah was going to be killed and buried. I mean, that's why there's her most valuable material possession. She was willing to lavish on Jesus. And he said it was a good thing. Do not think that, I mean, that's a statement that's easily taken. Jesus is aware of this. Why do you bother with this woman? She has done a good deed to me. For the poor you have with you always, but you do not always have me. Oh, it's kind of tapping on the poor, saying, oh, whatever, the poor is poor. Really? Didn't we just read the sheep and the goats? Okay? The sheep and the goats were, Jesus just said, if you see someone hungry, if you see somebody naked, without clothing, you see somebody without shelter, those are the poor, right? Typically, because rich wouldn't be without clothes, or food, or shelter. And what's he say? When you did that, you did it as to me. You did it, those are as if you did it to me. That you minister to these people and love these people. Did he say, don't worry about the poor, they'll always be here? That's not what he's saying. Okay? Because he just said, if you don't do that, if you don't reach out to those people, you're going to hell. That's a huge thing. If your love for me does not result in your love for others, if you are not obedient to love your neighbor as yourself, and you do not regard the people that I put in your life in front of your face as your neighbors, you're in trouble. Your love relationship with me is not real. And you're a goat, right? By not ministering to those who had need. So he's not diminishing that we should minister to those in need in any way, shape, or form. What is very important to get our heads wrapped around, and I have to admit, I personally struggle with it, is what does worship look like? And what is our cost of worship? Jesus said, this woman properly worshiped me. This person did what was right. This person had the right response to me. She was willing to worship a great God. All of us on some level, I think because of our culture, I would say that, and knowing most of you on some level, and me, absolutely for sure, tend to find worship that costs us a bunch of time, a bunch of effort, a bunch of our lives, is not having that much value. Right? What's the value? Well, it's more valuable. Quit, don't. What do you mean you worship? Go serve, go do something. Right? Go do good deeds. Go take care of people. Go talk to people. Go hand out tracts. Go do something that's worthwhile. What are you doing? Worshiping Jesus. What is, What does that look like? In this culture, how much priority, how much emphasis, how much importance, how much value do we put on meditation? How much value and importance do we put on, you know, we're all willing on some level, and this is a good thing, we're all willing on some level to give up our Sunday mornings, to give up our Tuesday nights, or to give up our Thursday nights, or to give up our Wednesday nights, and give up some hours to go do something with our brothers, right? Is this a good thing? This is a good thing. This is a good thing. This is, we're called to do that. But how much value do we put on worship? She put a huge value on honoring and worshiping Jesus. And Jesus said, this woman who is very spiritually discerning realizes that you take advantage of worshiping Jesus whenever you can, because it is a very, very high priority and thing of importance. We don't do that. It's not culturally, we're not like that. As people, we're not like that. As a society, we're not like that. Spend time meditating? Well, that's for kind of simple Hindus, you know, or something, right? I mean, that's for those more simple people that really can't be that productive in society because they're kind of impoverished anyway. Can't really get anything done. So for them to go out and sit on a rock and say, oh, I'm going to climb up a mountain on their knees or do something, that's kind of stupid. I'll say this. It's a tragic thing and my heart hurts for them, but I respect them more than I do most people who call themselves Christians in America. Because their priorities in some ways are right. They just are in darkness and not in truth. We mock them. We say, what a waste of life. You would spend a year crawling on your knees up a mountain to worship your God? Go to college. I mean, do something valuable. Get a job. Make a difference. There is nothing more important than worshiping God. And we say, well, Jesus isn't here now, so I guess we can do that one. Let's get on with it, okay? Really? Is Jesus here in His Spirit? Jesus is here in His Spirit. Okay? He said, it's better that I go away. Because then you don't have to waste time pouring perfume on me and spend a lot of money doing it. You can get about real important things. Feeding the poor and doing those things, right? Is that what He said? No, He said, it's better that I go because I will send my Spirit here now. So this is a better thing. So now each one of us has the opportunity to intimately worship the Spirit of God in the temple. That's about as serious as it gets. Right? Where is the temple? Where is the temple of God? And do we spend that time and value that time and willing to sacrifice the cost, whatever it costs, to be able to worship that time? I don't. And I'm sorry. And I ask your forgiveness and I ask God's forgiveness. And I want to change that. Okay? That the highest priority, the most important, valuable thing we can do is worship our God. Jesus said, this is a right thing. And those around Him were indignant and said, that's a waste of time. That's a waste of money. There's much better things we could have done. Much more valuable things we could have done. Jesus said, no, there isn't. No, there isn't. Again, this is a profound thing when you think about Jesus. Jesus never, he called himself, he referred in just the last parable was the first time he ever referred and called himself king. He's referring to himself in the parable, basically, right? He's a master. That was fairly well known. He called himself king. He did not, here pretty quickly, this woman who did this amazing act of contriteness, this amazing act of humility, rubbed the oil on his feet with her hair, went against tradition. Now, you know, this is actually an oil that was used for the hair, and was put in the hair, okay? But to take down, to let your hair down in public was suspect. To be in the, at this dinner table, typically, traditionally, they wouldn't have been there with this gathering of men, right? Disciples, guys there. He said he brought his disciples, right? And to let her hair down. She went against tradition. She humbled herself. She wasn't being flamboyant, you know. I realize most of it, take her hair down. You know, there's a posturing that comes with that, right? You know, that wasn't what she was doing. But she took her hair down and rubbed the oil on his feet, I'm sure, probably to get off the excess that was going to pick up dirt. You know, who knows? But this profound act is one that should challenge us. I mean, here's it. We don't have any idea of a husband. We don't have any idea of a dad anymore. You know, Lazarus was old. They were old. This is maybe the most valuable thing she held, is this alabaster box or vial of spikenard, of perfume. That was her treasury. And how do we respond? How do we respond to somebody putting that kind of extreme value on worshiping God? I would just encourage us all that this is, you know, we tend to think of our worship as being singing. Okay? You have to excuse me, but I love my daughter and I love Levi, and, you know, but if that's our worship with our lives, we're pathetic. Okay? I mean, yeah, it's not bad to sing. I'm not saying it's wrong to sing. I'm not sure what we need to change about it, but we need to change something. I'm not condemning you either, Becca. I appreciate it and I'm thankful for it. Okay? I'm thankful for it, but we're not overly enthusiastic, you know. It's not like we're fired up, you know, about worship. It's something that I consider. We tend to relegate that to, and that's a whole nother topic. Is it right to sing praises of adoration to our God? Is it right to sing words or to listen to words or to watch words that causes to question, is that truly the state of my heart? Is that really the state of my heart? Is that really where I'm at? Because it's also, you'll have to excuse me, a very dangerous thing to say things in your mouth that aren't true. You know? And I don't think that singing is supposed to be a way of trying to self-deceive ourselves. Okay? I'm okay with the realness. Okay? Don't get me wrong. Okay? In fact, I have a harder time with the ability to stir up a level of fervency in feelings that make me feel really good about my relationship with God. They're necessarily no more based in reality. Okay? But we can certainly stir that up and do it. We all know that. We all know what music has the power to do and the ability to do. Okay? That would scare me just as much. I would rather be much more simple with it. I would rather be much more simple and have us all, I don't know if you do, but I know I do, go, am I just saying these words, or do I mean these words, or is this the voice of my heart? Am I just rattling something with my mouth? Or, wow, really? Is that what that says? You know? Blessed be your name. Is that how I feel? Is that where my heart's really at? I think that's a good thing to question. And at this point, I would find that much more, what would I say, organic. Okay? Without a lot of extra. is a lot more real than the ability to go. I mean, cathedrals in Europe were made. We tend to emulate that. Cathedrals in Europe were made to just be, and the music that was played in them was made to just absolutely move you. I mean, they were meant to be this, this moving, powerful instrument, have you, that stirred you and moved you, right? And there's potentially value if that's truly where your heart's at. Okay? If that's really where you're coming from. But I'm always remiss to say, should we worship God with our emotions? Absolutely. Absolutely we should worship God with our emotions. He gave us our emotions. And primarily He gave us our emotions to worship Him. Okay? But it's very easy to feel way better about my praise and worship of God because of the way I just felt than because of the way I just lived. And because of the way I just interacted with my brothers and sisters. I look at the produce of the cathedrals, and it concerns me greatly. I look at the produce of contemporary music, and it concerns me. Okay? Of contemporary Christian music even, and it concerns me. You know, where do I see? I look at the hymns that were much deeper and much more intense and much more complex and much more honoring in some ways than our stupid whiny music of today. Okay? It's like a bunch of skinny jean whiny little crap being sought by a boys band, you know, or something. It's troubling to me. That's not always. There's obviously different. But there's too much, way too much of it like that. It's, I don't know what you'd call it, emo music or something, you know? I mean, makes me feel good. And, you know, I would challenge us all, and I would leave it at that, because we really have the important part of what to do, and that's love on each other. But I would challenge us all to think of what value do we place on worship? And are we willing to be led by the Spirit of God and spiritually discerning? Jesus' statement to her was basically, do not bother her. She's very spiritually discerning, and she is preparing me for burial. She knows what's happening. She's being led by the Spirit of God. She is tremendously moved to love on me and minister to me and worship me with her life, with her dowry, with her most valued possession. She's willing to pour it out in honor of me. And he revered her for that. He revered her for that. And I would contend that all of us could be stretched a lot from that. Instead of having our natural inclination of, oh, just sitting here thinking about Jesus, man, I've got a lot of important things to do. Oh, I've got things I need to go do. I need to be active. Okay, let me study, let me read, let me go through my prayers, check it off. Now I need to be about it, because God wouldn't want me to sit here and be idle. She wasn't doing something idle. She was pouring herself out to her Savior, to her Master, to her King. Put yourself in those shoes. Did the rest of the people really realize what was going to happen here in the next couple of days? I don't think so. I don't think so. Or they wouldn't have questioned what she did. I mean, Jesus was going to be beaten was going to be mocked, was going to be put in our place, was going to be savagely and brutally and terribly murdered in our place. Let's pray. My King and my Master, I speak more to myself than to anyone else. I don't know what right worship of you looks like. I'm not very good at it. My priorities and my understanding of importance and value are skewed. God, I ask you to cause us to be more like Mary. More like Mary from Bethany that wanted to sit at Jesus' feet. Earlier, at another time, at a dinner when they were together, Martha, who seemed to be fixing dinner at this one too, which very thankful for her, came and complained to Jesus and said, "She's not helping me. I'm trying to make dinner and there's all these people and she's not helping me. I mean, shouldn't she be? I thought she was supposed to be serving. That's not right." And Jesus said, "She's sitting at my feet. She's got her priorities right. He is Jesus. He is Jesus." And she seemed to know who Jesus was, who Jesus is. You are worthy to be worshipped. You are worthy to be honored. That nothing else has priority over that. That doesn't mean we should be lazy and sit around not helping the kitchen. Hopefully we all have that understanding today that we're here to serve each other. But what does it mean? What does it mean to worship you with every opportunity we have? She had a little window of time to prepare Jesus for burial. She didn't know what it would look like, but I believe she was led by your Spirit to know that there wouldn't be time to prepare his body. He was going to be raised before they had the ability to go back and do that on the day he raised. But he was beaten. Terribly beaten, flesh ripped off his body. She knew that, and she was honoring him with the valuable thing, most valuable thing probably in her life. God caused us to understand that, to be challenged by it, to renew our concept of what worship looks like, not to diminish serving, because you made it pretty clear right before this that that's what your life will look like. It will look like serving others. Not yourself. Look like serving others sacrificially, or you're a goat and in danger of the hell of fire. Bless our time. God, I thank you for the food. I'll thank you for it now. Thank you that we can gather together and eat as your children, as your family. God, I ask you to please encourage and stimulate us to love each other as family. Because that's what we're called to be. You say the bond we have as your children is tighter than the bond we have with the blood of our parents. Cause us to know that and experience that and value that. Protect us. Protect us from the enemy. Amen.